place that, if it were suddenly torn down, you wouldn't remember what it looked like. Matthew labored to make it more attractive, putting in some sago palms and even some lights under the trees. He was certainly the world's best tenant. Within a few weeks, he knew everybody on the block. We understood that his presence among us was a kind of secret. The world seemed out of balance. Matthew was by now a multimillionaire. His face was all over the newsstands. Anything I might have envied in terms of money and fame, he had in abundance. And yet, there he was, mowing the yard of a modest little rent house in Tarrytown. He was from Uvalde, west of San Antonio, about an hour's drive from Mexico. He had gone to the University of Texas and was a big Longhorns fan. He got his break in the movie business in Dazed and Confused by Austin filmmaker Richard Linklater, so there were many ties. But if he wanted to come back to Austin to live, there were much grander residences to consider, for instance, the house I couldn't afford. It finally occurred to me that what Matthew wanted was what I already had, a quiet existence on a pretty street, with nice neighbors and a degree of anonymity that was hard to come by for a face as recognizable as his. He wanted to somehow return to ordinary life, and I wanted to escape it. On a Saturday afternoon, before the UT Baylor football game, Matthew invited the neighbors over for a cookout. He and Roberta talked about the team. She is not a real sports fan, but she had gotten a bit of a crush on the UT quarterback, Major Applewhite, a scrappy, undersized redhead who led many memorable fourth-quarter comebacks. He's now the head coach at the University of Houston. Matthew was well known for hanging out with the players, so I teased Roberta by saying that he had met Major Applewhite. Roberta's jaw dropped. "You know Major Applewhite?" she exclaimed. Matthew burst into laughter. I think at that moment he must have felt that he had really done it. He had achieved ordinary life. One autumn night in 1999, around 3 a.m., I was awakened by the sound of loud talking and dogs barking. I tried to go back to sleep, but I heard car doors shutting, more barking, and then the instantly recognizable sound of a police scanner. I jumped up and pulled back the shade. There were four police cruisers in front of our house. "Roberta," I said, "something's going down." There was a cop standing in my yard when I came out. "Sir, do you live here?" he asked. I nodded. "What's going on?" "We made an arrest at that house," he said, indicating Matthew's bungalow. Then he asked if I knew the person who lived there. "Yes, it's Matthew McConaughey. Is that who you arrested?" The cop told me that Matthew was being charged with being disorderly and having a small amount of narcotics. I noticed Matthew in the back of one of the cruisers. "Can I talk to him?" I asked. "No, he's in a stupor," the cop said. He didn't look like he was in a stupor to me. He was spitting mad. "Someone in the neighborhood called in a complaint," the cop said. "Actually, they called twice. He was disturbing the peace." "You're the ones who woke me up," I said. The cop was clearly morose. "The females in my family think he's the greatest guy," he said. He added that the cop who made the arrest hadn't known who Matthew was. That was the reason for the squad car convention. An unmarked car pulled up and all the cops went into a huddle. They wound up taking Matthew downtown. "We're going to low profile it," the cop assured me. "Yeah, good luck with that." The news broke around noon. The story was that Matthew had been dancing around in the back of his house, naked, playing the bongos. Apparently, he had left his back door open and annoyed a neighbor across the fence. When the cops arrived, they had spotted what they thought was a bong, so it turned into a drug bust. The cops burst into his den, and when Matthew yelled at them, they cuffed him. Then they swept up a bunch of his belongings in black trash bags for evidence. As it turned out, there were no drugs. Everybody in town was on Matthew's side. Even Laura Bush confided at a party the next day that she was shocked at how the cops had behaved, entering a person's house without permission and no warrant. By that time, there were TV trucks stationed in front of our house. The tabloid press was all over the story. It was galling to see how the press behaves around celebrity news. That's one reason people hate reporters, even though this is exactly the kind of news they love to consume. The local paper committed the unpardonable sin of publishing Matthew's address, and after that our little street became a promenade of mothers pushing strollers and teenagers knocking on Matthew's door at all hours. Someone drove a nail into a tire on his van. The drug charges were dropped, but he paid a $50 fine for disturbing the peace. His fantasy of slipping back into ordinary life was punctured. The bongo incident ruined it for me, he confided on the morning he packed his furniture into a moving van. He could never feel safe here again. I talked to Steve about Matthew's broken dream of a normal existence. Steve was sympathetic, but he observed that movie stars like Matthew cultivate celebrity and can't expect to escape notoriety. In any case, he's not a normal person, Steve said. He's a wild man living in Tarrytown. Donald Trump's unexpected victory marked a cultural turning point all over America. There were protests around the country, including in Austin, where on the Sunday after the election, about 150 people gathered on the Capitol steps and marched south down Congress Avenue. A small group of Trump supporters staged a counter-protest. According to the news reports, one man was especially conspicuous, Joseph Widenecht, a laid-off sheet metal worker who stands 6'6" and weighs 350 pounds. He was wearing a Make America Great Again gimme cap and carried a sign, Proud to be Deplorable, a reference to Hillary Clinton's derogatory remark about Trump supporters. A number of the anti-Trump marchers, some wearing Guy Fawkes masks, began to mock him. They ripped the sign out of his hands and grabbed the hat off his head, then tried to set his shirt on fire. I can handle myself in a brawl, Widenecht later said, but when they brought out the lighters, I was genuinely scared for my life. Suddenly, a small woman wearing a hijab forced herself between Widenecht and the people who were assaulting him. Amina Abdin, a 19-year-old student at UT, had immigrated to the United States from Iraq when she was 10. She stood there like a mountain, trying to stop the violence, Widenecht said. I do not stand for what he stands for, Abdin remarked after the police had arrived and arrested six of the protesters. But I know his fears and concerns are valid. I love this country so much, and I don't like what I see coming. As the new administration was attempting to block Muslims from entering the United States, anti-immigrant posters started appearing on campus buildings. Imagine a Muslim-free America, one said. A mosque was firebombed in Victoria in South Texas. Sid Miller, the boisterous agricultural commissioner, told the BBC that he worried about America becoming a Muslim country. Muslims account for about 1% of the U.S. population. He previously advocated dropping nuclear bombs on the Muslim world. One of Roberta's close friends is a writer who is married to a professor. They are Jewish. They have a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard. As Senate Bill 4, targeting sanctuary cities, was being debated at the Capitol, an unsigned letter was slipped under their front door, threatening the lives of their children by name. Is this Austin? Roberta cried. Chapter 10. More Sausage. Texas is the nation's largest red state, with 38 electoral votes, which will likely increase to 41 or 42 after the next census. California has 55 electoral votes, but it hasn't increased that number since 2003. New York has 29, but that number has been declining for decades. If Texas went blue, there would be a Democratic electoral lock on the presidency. Republican margins of victory within the state have been shrinking for years, and the demographics suggest that Texas should already be in the blue column. It's a young, urban state with a majority of minority citizens. It should be as reliably blue as California. Instead, it is the red planet in the political universe. The only real election in Texas is the Republican primary, where normally about 1.5 million voters turn out. If you win 750,001 primary votes in a state of 27 million people, you can become governor or a U.S. senator. In 2012, Ted Cruz got the nomination with only 631,000 votes in a runoff. This happened despite the fact that he is such an un-Texan political figure, a Princeton and Harvard man, who in another era would have fit comfortably with British imperialists in their grand club rooms, perhaps sporting a mustache and a monocle. The fact that Cruz didn't cancel his Canadian passport until 2014 suggested to me that he was hedging his bets, culturally speaking. There was hope for the Democrats in 2014 that Wendy Davis, a glamorous blonde who captured national attention through her 11-hour filibuster to block a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, would be the champion that Texas Democrats needed if they were to regain the statehouse, but she lost in a landslide to Greg Abbott. She even lost the women's vote. The 2016 presidential season promised to have a Texas stamp on it, with Perry and Cruz in the primary, along with Jeb Bush and Rand Paul, both of whom grew up in the state, and Carly Fiorina, who was born in Austin. They all washed out. Then, in early September, while the race between Trump and Clinton was tightening nationally, a Washington Post Survey Monkey poll showed Hillary Clinton ahead in Texas by 1 point. Other polls showed Trump very narrowly ahead. This in a state that Mitt Romney carried in 2012 by 16 points. Texans aren't used to being in play. We don't have the deluge of television ads and candidate forums that swing states experience during presidential election cycles, or the strife and anxiety that attend meaningful contests. For nearly four decades, the outcome in Texas has been so clearly preordained that it was like watching the election from abroad. In May, Hillary Clinton excited expectations when she said in an interview with New York Magazine, "If black and Latino voters come out and vote, we could win Texas." But her campaign director in Texas, Gary Morrow, quickly tried to douse unrealistic expectations. "We are not a battleground state," he insisted. Hope would not be quenched, however. The Democratic Party, which hasn't even got offices in many counties in the state and had practically no identifiable candidates running for statewide office, stirred to life and began setting up operations in key cities. Senator Tim Kaine, the vice presidential nominee, visited the state repeatedly, saying that he and Clinton take Texas very seriously. The Dallas Morning News endorsed Clinton, the first Democrat the newspaper had chosen in 75 years. In October, the Clinton campaign began a modest media effort in the state's major cities, something that hadn't happened in decades. In Austin, 90% of qualified voters were registered, along with 80% of all qualified voters statewide. Texans were wrought up. A mother in a Houston suburb kicked her 7-year-old son out of the house when he cast the wrong vote in a mock election at his school. She actually made a video of the scene. "Bye, Donald Trump lover," she says as she forces the hysterical child out of the house with a suitcase and a sign, "My mom kicked me out because I voted for Donald Trump." The mother later claimed it was a joke, but the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services opened an investigation. There was a telling obituary in the Houston Chronicle that read, "Eileen Meyer Davis was born in Yoakum, Texas, on the 7th of October, 1924, and died on the 7th of June, 2016, of complications due to congestive heart failure and the 2016 presidential campaign." Despite the tumult and the expectations of a record turnout, only 42.62% of the registered voters actually went to the polls in Texas, again, one of the lowest in the nation. Young people in the 18 to 24 range vote at less than half the rate of those who are between 65 and 75. Only about 40% of those with a family income under $25,000 per year tend to vote, compared with about 75% of those whose income is above $75,000. Those with less than a high school education turn out to vote at a rate of 32%. A scale that rises to 82% for those with advanced degrees. The fact that turnout is chronically lower in Texas has less to do with race than it does with its disproportionate number of young, poor, and uneducated citizens. As Wendy Davis observed, Texas is not a red state. It's a non-voting blue state. Trump carried Texas by 9 points, 52% to 43%, the same margin as Ohio. And when I looked at the distribution of votes throughout the country, the blue cities against a blanket of red, it was hard to see where Texas ended and the rest of the country began. It is a red country with blue freckles. Texas leads the nation in Latino population growth. Latinos account for more than half the 2.7 million new Texans since 2010. Every Democrat in Texas believes that if Hispanics voted at the same rate in Texas as they do in California, the state would already be blue. The difference between Texas and California is the labor movement, Garnet Coleman, a Houston member of the Texas House of Representatives, told me. In the 1960s, Cesar Chavez began organizing the California farm workers into a union, which didn't happen in Texas, a right-to-work state. Labor unions create a culture of voting and political participation, Coleman observed. In Texas politics, Coleman believes, everything is about race. It's veiled as public policy, but it encourages people to believe that their tax dollars are going to support lazy black and brown people. Political views have become more entrenched because of redistricting, and yet the demographic majority in Texas is far more progressive than its representatives. Coleman predicts a showdown. This is the battle about the future of the country, based on a new majority, and we have to have this out. Among Republicans who vote in Texas primaries, immigration is the hottest issue. Many state legislators who otherwise might not support SB 4 seemed intimidated by the political environment, and it was apparent that Speaker Strauss and his team had no battle plan. One of Strauss's chief lieutenants, Charlie Guerin of Fort Worth, presented the bill in April 2017, which he offered up to the will of the House. That was an invitation to Dan Patrick's frustrated counterparts to pile on. Matt Schaefer, the leader of the Freedom Caucus, amended the bill to allow police officers to question a suspect's immigration status, a show-me-your-papers provision that would place every Hispanic citizen in the state in a different class from Anglos. Law enforcement authorities in Texas's major cities had loudly opposed such an idea, saying that it would make immigrants less likely to report crimes. Art Acevedo, Houston's police chief, said that the number of Hispanics reporting rape in his city was already down 43%. Schaefer's amendment was similar to a 2010 Arizona law that had been partly struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. "This is something that Texans in our district have been asking for," Schaefer said. "This is good policy." Gene Wu, a House member from Houston who was born in China, spoke against the bill, tearfully comparing it to the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, America's first major anti-immigration law. "This topic is painful for me because I'm an immigrant," he said. "My parents are immigrants. I represent a district filled with immigrants." As he spoke, supportive Democrats surrounded him. "Some are here as refugees," he continued. "Some are here as citizens. Some are here without papers, but they are all my people." For Wu, the Sanctuary Cities Bill was a natural culmination of the bigoted racist mentality that has emerged in Texas, which he calls the epicenter of the Tea Party. "Trump is simply the most visible manifestation of that mentality," he told me. "It's been percolating up in the Republican Party for the past decade." Another Democratic lawmaker, Ana Hernandez of Houston, recalled coming to this country as a child. "I remember the constant fear my family lived with each day, the fear my parents experienced each day as their two little girls went to school, not knowing if there would be an immigration raid that day." Behind the scenes, the Republican and Democratic caucuses met for hours, trying to find a way to dodge Schaefer's amendment. "The Republicans came to us and said, 'Some of us are going to have a hard time voting against it,'" Wu told me. Knowing that the law would be challenged in court, the Republicans offered to shelve the amendment if the Democrats made some minor concessions. But the Democrats took too long to agree on terms, and the Republicans withdrew the offer. After 16 hours of emotional debate, ending at 3 in the morning, the House passed SB 4 with the Show Me Your Papers amendment. A week later, Governor Abbott signed it into law on Facebook Live. "Citizens expect law enforcement officers to enforce the law," he said. "Citizens deserve lawbreakers to face legal consequences." As usual, the legislature passed a sweeping anti-abortion bill, one that bans the safest and most common procedure for second trimester abortions, dilation and evacuation. The law also requires healthcare facilities to bury or cremate aborted fetuses. In addition, the legislature passed several bills to reform the agencies that oversee abused and endangered children, one of the governor's priorities. In the first 7 months of the state's 2017 fiscal year, 314 foster children spent two or more nights in hotels or government offices. The new legislation gave raises to the underpaid caseworkers, but also stripped the state of some responsibility for its wards, handing that off to private contractors. Abbott said that Janice Graham Jack, the federal judge who ruled that Texas's foster care system violated children's rights, should dismiss the case because the new legislation completely transforms the system in ways that will make it better. Abbott said that he expected that the state foster care agencies would achieve number one ranking status in the United States of America. Child welfare advocates worried that private groups might not have the expertise to take over case management duties, particularly when dealing with troubled children. The feral hog abatement program passed, despite Jonathan Stickland's opposition. And a new law allows hunting wild pigs from hot air balloons. Texans could already shoot the pigs from helicopters using actual machine guns, but balloons are more sporting. And who knew it was ever against the law to shoot pigs from balloons? Speaker Strauss continued to sideline the bathroom bill in the House. He remained certain that most of his members didn't really favor the measure, though they also didn't want to be seen as opposing it. He repeatedly called on the governor to stand with him. Until this session, Abbott had been known more as a business conservative like Strauss than a cultural conservative like Patrick, but he showed little interest in choosing sides. He was bound to lose favor in either case. Finally, Abbott blandly stated that he favored a bill to protect privacy in bathrooms. He signaled that a bill then headed for a committee hearing in the House, HB 2899, was a thoughtful proposal. It would not mandate bathroom use based on one's biological sex at birth, but it would overturn local anti-discrimination ordinances. On May 21st, the House began to debate the measure. Once again, hours of anguished testimony ensued. Half a dozen female members wandered into the men's bathroom just off the House floor. "We're feeling like making trouble today," one of the women, Gina Hinojosa, a Democrat from Austin, told reporters. "It's that kind of mood." I wondered whether minds are ever actually changed in these kinds of hearings. This legislative session had already endured many late nights, even on this subject. The people had the opportunity to make themselves heard. That's their fundamental democratic right. By an outsized margin, they spoke against the bathroom bill. Among the many affecting facts that lawmakers had to consider was the vulnerability of the transgender population, which is already bullied and stigmatized. A study by the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law in 2014 found that more than 40% of transgender individuals attempt suicide, more than twice the rate among gay and bisexual adults, and nearly 10 times higher than the U.S. average. Shortly before dawn, the House committee members retired without a vote, effectively killing the measure. At the last minute, several members scrambled to sign on as co-sponsors for a dead bill, the most desirable outcome imaginable. There were still 8 days left in the session. one of the motive forces behind the bathroom bill, and a major supporter of Dan Patrick, is Dr. Stephen Hotz, a Houston physician and longtime ultra-conservative kingmaker. Starting in the 1990s, he made a fortune from alternative hormone replacement therapies and the sale of controversial supplements, such as colloidal silver, which Dr. Hotz recommends for colds, flu, and even pet health. Colloidal silver can cause argyria, a condition in which a patient's skin permanently turns the color of a blue jay. Hotz is affiliated with an evangelical Christian group called the Coalition on Revival. He signed their manifesto in 1986, which endorses the idea that the ultimate cause of all disease, deformity, disability, and death is the sin of Adam and Eve. As for government, we deny that any final authority outside the Bible, for instance, reason, experience, majority opinion, elite opinion, nature, etc., ought to be accepted as the standard of government for any individual group or jurisdiction. Hotz has hosted a show on the talk radio station that Patrick now owns in Houston. He has even released a couple of songs, or perhaps they should be called lamentations, such as God-Fearing Texans Stop Obamacare. What would Sam Houston do? What would Davy Crockett do? I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to fight Obamacare. I'm going to defeat Obamacare. Hotz's main cause is attacking homosexuals, or homofascists, as he calls them. The homosexual political movement will force churches, schools, businesses, and individuals to accept, to affirm, and even celebrate those who participate in anal sex, he has said. Sodomy, he went on, will be mandated to be taught to children in the schools at an early age, starting in kindergarten. It goes without saying that homosexuals want to make Texas a clone of California. He is the LeBron James of hating on gays, Evan Smith, the CEO of the Texas Tribune, told me. He's the MVP every year. There's no close second. In 2014, when Dan Patrick first ran for lieutenant governor, Hotz became one of his chief fundraisers. In a video endorsement, he stands next to Patrick and says, "Dan Patrick's leadership will keep Texas the most conservative state in the country." In the video, Patrick makes it clear what the stakes are in his election. The Democrats understand that if they can take Texas, they'll never have a Republican in the White House again, he says. They will control the country. There's not another Texas to move to, folks. This is it. In 2015, Hotz became involved in defeating an anti-discrimination ordinance in Houston that was championed by the city's lesbian mayor, Anise Parker. Hotz passed out bumper stickers saying, "No men in women's bathrooms," the same formulation that Patrick and his colleagues would apply to SB 6, which they styled the Women's Privacy Act. Hotz now runs a political action committee called Conservative Republicans of Texas, and he maintains that group's website. "There are Texas legislators," Hotz wrote on the site in May 2017, "who would allow perverted men and boys who sexually fantasize that they are women to enter women and girls' bathrooms, showers, and locker rooms." He implored his readers to pray with him. "In the name of Jesus, I prophesy and declare, may all the individuals serving in the state legislature and their staff who support, promote, and practice sodomy and other perverted sexually deviant lifestyles, who support the killing of unborn babies, and who hate God's law and God's word, receive just retribution from God for their evil actions. May they be consumed, collapse, rot, and be blown away as dust from their current positions because of their wicked works, thoughts, and deeds. May people scorn them and nations abhor them. May their punishment lead them to repentance and faith in Christ. Christ, may God's will be done in their lives." In an email to me, Patrick's office described Hotz as a longtime supporter, but added, "The lieutenant governor does not agree with everything that any of his supporters say or do." Strauss told me, "Steve Hotz exists on the fringes. Mainstream Republicans don't take him seriously." Meanwhile, Hotz was campaigning to have Strauss removed as speaker. In the middle of all this political chaos, Tom Meckler, chairman of the state Republican Party, resigned. He issued a letter pleading for unity and civility. A party that is fractured by anger and backbiting is a party that will not succeed, he wrote in his resignation note. He also warned that Republicans had failed to attract voters beyond the shrinking Anglo electorate and was destined for electoral extinction. If we do not continue to make efforts to engage in the diverse communities across Texas, our state will turn blue, he warned. He urged that the next chairman reshape the party in the image of modern Texas. Soon after Meckler's resignation, Rob Morrow, the former Travis County GOP chairman with the Motley Fool hat, announced his candidacy for the statewide position. His priorities had not changed since he was drummed out of the county office. I like big titties. I am a proponent of boobiliciousness. In the past several years, I have shared on social media the pics of over 500 extremely hot, busty women. He concluded by saying, I am for having bikini contests at the Alamo every 4th of July. Case closed. The 12 members of the ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus were furious at Strauss and his allies for keeping their bills off the floor, legislation that included yet more bills targeting abortion and measures that would further loosen gun laws. They decided to get revenge. It was called the Mother's Day Massacre. Bills that are not considered controversial are often placed on the local and consent calendar. Included were 121 uncontested bills awaiting a pro forma vote in the House. However, if five or more members object to a bill, it must then go through the normal legislative process and be scheduled for discussion on the House floor. The clock for such discussions ran out at midnight on May 11th, the Thursday before Mother's Day weekend. Hours before midnight, the Freedom Caucus objected to the entire slate of consent bills, making it impossible for them to be heard in the 2017 session. The doomed consent bills included two that addressed the sharp rise in maternal mortality in Texas. Sean Theory, a Democrat from Houston, begged Freedom Caucus members to spare her bill, which would have commissioned a study that focused on low-income black mothers. Theory herself had nearly died giving birth 4 years before because of a severe reaction to an epidural. She was 42 years old at the time, an age when pregnancy complications are more likely. But I certainly didn't know that I was three times more likely to die by virtue of being African American, she said after reading a state-issued report. She argued that her bill was pro-life because the mothers who died in childbirth had carried their babies to term. The Freedom Caucus members agreed with her on this point, but they refused her request, explaining that it wasn't personal. It was like a drive-by shooting, Theory later said. Next, the Freedom Caucus chewed up time in leisurely debate, bringing the House to a standstill. An hour passed as they considered inconsequential amendments to a bill on industrial workforce training. It was an old tactic, perfected by minority Democrats in the past. Drew Springer, the representative from North Texas who killed Strickland's anti-hog abatement amendment, pleaded for HB 810, which would fund experimental stem cell treatments. He spoke on behalf of his wife, who was in a wheelchair. Such treatments might give somebody like my wife a chance to walk, he said between sobs, as supporters gathered around the microphone. I'll trade every single bill I've ever passed, every single one, to get the chance to hear HB 810. The Freedom Caucus gave in on this one and it passed. Among the slain consent bills was HB 3302, a sunset safety net bill. It had been crafted to preserve important state agencies that would otherwise be phased out under the automatic review policy, which takes place every 12 years. One of the five agencies up for review was the state medical board. If the medical board expired, there would be no one to license doctors. It wasn't clear if members of the Freedom Caucus had realized the far-reaching consequences of killing HB 3302. Dan Patrick, however, recognized that an important lever had been handed to him. The only way to avoid the consequences of HB 3302 failing to pass was for a similar bill to be passed in the Senate, which had a later deadline, and then be sent back to the House. On the Monday after Mother's Day, Strauss wrote a letter to Patrick formally requesting that the Senate pass such a bill, along with the budget, so that the legislature could avoid a special session. In response, Patrick privately sent him the specific terms for such a deal. The House had to pass the bathroom bill and another of Patrick's priorities, a bill that intended to put a brake on local property taxes. In return, the Senate would agree to pass its own version of the Sunset Safety Net bill, as well as the budget and several other items, including one championed by Strauss, which dealt with school finance reform. Over the years, the state's contribution to public schools has sharply diminished, with property taxes having to make up the difference. To restore the balance, Strauss wanted to add $1.5 billion from the state to the public schools. However, Patrick's offer came with what Strauss called a poison pill, a provision for vouchers for private schools, which the House had already firmly rejected. Moreover, under Patrick's terms, the state's contribution would be a fraction of what Strauss proposed. Patrick felt that Texas schools had enough money. In an op-ed published in early June, he noted that total education spending, including universities, was already the largest item in the budget, about 52% of all state dollars. He added, "It is disingenuous to suggest that we are somehow holding back funding that we could spend on schools." PolitiFact pointed out that education spending, as a percentage of the Texas budget, is lower than it has been in at least 20 years. It is among the lowest per capita in the country. By now, the ill will between Patrick and Strauss had spilled over into the chambers they led. San Antonio Republican Lyle Larson, who is close to Strauss, accused the Senate of taking hostages when it promised to pass certain House bills only if the House voted for Patrick's priorities. "I've got six," Larson cried. "How many other bills were being held hostage by the Texas Senate?" A roar went up in the House, which only increased in volume when Democrat Harold Dutton, a black state representative from Houston, took the microphone. "When the Senate won't respect us, they need to expect us," he said. "I don't know if they can see us, but would you open the door so they can hear us?" The House doors were flung open as the frustrated representatives bayed like wolves at the Senate chamber. Governor Abbott had warned Strauss that he would demand action on the bathroom bill, even if he had to call a special session to get it. With the Speaker's blessing, a compromise was crafted by Chris Patty, a Republican representative from Marshall. It was styled as an amendment to a bill on school safety and would affect grade schools and high schools, but not universities or government buildings. It affirmed the right of all students to use the bathroom with privacy, dignity, and safety, but it did not explicitly bar students from using particular bathrooms. Across Texas, school districts and chambers of commerce seemed resigned to accept the amendment. In Strauss's opinion, it codified a reasonable practice that many schools had already adopted. Still, there was bitter opposition in the House by members who saw it as appeasement. Rafael Antia, a Democratic state representative from Dallas, reminded the other members that since January, when they began debating the bathroom issue, 10 transgender people had been violently killed in the United States. He read their names aloud. The amendment passed the House, but it didn't satisfy Patrick. Strauss refused to go further. He declared that Patrick could take Patty's amendment or leave it. "For many of us, and especially for me, this was a compromise. As far as I'm concerned, it was enough. We will go no further. This is the right thing to do in order to protect our economy from billions of dollars in losses, and more importantly, to protect the safety of some very vulnerable young Texans." He added that it was absurd that the bathroom bill had taken on more urgency than fixing the school finance system. Patrick called a press conference shortly afterward. He said of Strauss's remarks, Instead of siding with the people of Texas, and as a Republican, siding with Republicans of Texas, he has decided to support the policies of Barack Obama, who said, "I want boys and girls in every shower in every school in the country." Obama never said that. Patrick then added a remark aimed directly at the reluctant Governor Abbott. "Tonight I'm making it very clear, Governor. I want you to call us back on your own time." The two chambers succeeded in passing a budget, but a special session seemed inevitable. Abbott clearly hated the position he had been thrust into. He had said repeatedly that there was still time in the regular session to resolve these issues, but time had now run out. A special session devoted almost entirely to the bathroom bill would focus even more unwanted national attention on Texas. To add to the pressure, on May 27th, the CEOs of 14 companies with a significant presence in Texas, including Apple, Amazon, Cisco, Google, and IBM, sent Abbott a letter. "We are gravely concerned that any such legislation would deeply tarnish Texas's reputation as open and friendly to businesses and families," it said. "The bill would harm the company's ability to recruit talent to the state," they asserted, adding, "discrimination is wrong, and it has no place in Texas." Ray Perryman, a respected economist in Waco, did his own study of the bathroom bill. He forecast that its passage would cost the state $3.3 billion in gross state product and the loss of 36,000 jobs, most of them in the tourist industry. Indeed, convention bookings in the state were already suffering cancellations while the measure was being discussed. Reporters caught up with Abbott at a gun range, where he signed a bill lowering the cost of handgun licenses. "Texans' ability to bear arms is going to be even bolder today than it's ever been before," he said. He then shot a few rounds at a target sheet, which he proudly displayed to the reporters, who have generally been very kind to him. This was the day after Montana had held a special election and chosen as U.S. representative a candidate who had body-slammed a reporter, sending him to the hospital. It was also the same season in which Trump had declared the press to be the enemy. Abbott held up his bullet-riddled target and said, "I'm going to carry this around in case I see any reporters." "On the Friday before the end of the regular session," Strauss told me, "the lieutenant governor sent two emissaries from the Senate to visit with the speaker in his office. They seemed nervous. One of the senators carried an envelope, apparently containing the language of the bathroom bill that Patrick would accept. The senator, a lawyer whose name Strauss would not disclose, told Strauss that the language had been carefully crafted to ensure that the bill would override any local anti-discrimination ordinances. The senator started to open the envelope, but Strauss said not to bother. "I'm not a lawyer, but I am a Texan," he said. "I'm disgusted by all this. Tell the lieutenant governor I don't want the suicide of a single Texan on my hands." During the regular session of the 85th Texas Legislature, more than 6,600 bills were filed, and more than 1,200 were passed and sent to the governor to sign. The session was widely viewed as being dictated by Dan Patrick, but many of the signature items he sought—school vouchers, property tax rollbacks, and the bathroom bill—failed to pass. The major cities in Texas quickly joined in a lawsuit against SB 4, the Sanctuary Cities Bill, saying that its provisions would lead to racial profiling and that regulating immigration is a power reserved for the federal government. However, the U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, announced that the Justice Department was on the side of SB 4. "President Trump has made a commitment to keep America safe," he said. Texas has admirably followed his lead by mandating statewide cooperation with federal immigration laws that require the removal of illegal aliens who have committed crimes. Faced with the possibility of being incarcerated in her own jail if she disobeyed federal immigration detention requests, Travis County Sheriff Sally Hernandez said that her office would comply with the new law. The last day of the session, Memorial Day, is usually spent in presentations of proclamations, commendations to the staff, and goodbyes among colleagues who have endured 140 of the most intense days of their lives together. Some of the members will retire. Others may be defeated in the next election. Those who endure will be back in 18 months for another round. Meanwhile, buses began arriving at the Capitol. Hundreds of protesters, some from distant states, burst through the doors, filling all four levels of the rotunda and spilling into the House gallery. They blew whistles and unfurled banners, "See you in court," and chanted, "SB4 has got to go." One of the leaders of the protests, Stephanie Garakanyan, explained to reporters, "We wanted to make sure we gave them the send-off they deserve." The House came to a halt amid the pandemonium. A few of the Democrats on the floor looked up at the chanting protesters and began to applaud. State troopers cleared the gallery and broke up the demonstration, but by that time, the attempted bonhomie that usually characterizes the final day had blown up. Matt Rinaldi, a member of the Freedom Caucus from Dallas County, who is sometimes rated the most conservative member of the House, later told Fox Business Network that he noticed several banners bearing the message, "I am undocumented and here to stay." He says he decided to summon Immigration and Customs Enforcement and then bragged about it to his Hispanic colleagues. A shoving match broke out on the House floor. Curses flew along with spittle. Afterward, Rinaldi posted on Facebook that Alfonso Poncho Navarez, a Democrat from the border town of Eagle Pass, had threatened his life. "Poncho told me he would get me on the way to my car," Rinaldi wrote. He said he made it clear that I would shoot him in self-defense. The Capitol was subdued the day after the session ended. In the House chamber, docents were leading school tours and explaining, in English and Spanish, the identities of the famous Texans in the portraits along the walls. I like the one of Stephen F. Austin with his musket, a spotted hound at his feet. In the rotunda, a high school orchestra was playing a piece for woodwinds. I went up on the second floor tier, where the acoustics were better. The students were from Kuntz, a little East Texas town that had the distinction, in 1991, of electing America's first Muslim mayor. The musicians were arrayed in the center of the rotunda, atop the seals of the Republic and the five other nations that Texas had once been a part of. I was moved by the thought that the long and bloody march of Texas history had paused at this moment, with small-town kids bringing all the diverse voices of our state into harmony. Speaker Strauss was waiting in his chambers, seated on his couch in his shirt sleeves under a painting of Hereford cattle. He looked more relaxed than I thought was warranted, given that the governor was poised to call a special session that would likely focus on Patrick's two must-pass bills. But Strauss seemed satisfied. He boasted that the priorities of the House, his priorities, had been mostly accomplished. "We did the Child Protective Services reforms, adding 1,400 new caseworkers," he said. "We made tremendous progress on mental health reforms. Texas's decrepit hospitals were going to be upgraded. A health care plan for retired teachers was saved. Massive cuts to higher education were averted. These were issues a little bit under the radar because they're not sensational, but they're issues that are going to make a big difference in Texas lives," Strauss said. "What we didn't achieve was to begin fixing the school finance system, which everybody knows is a disaster." Strauss said that schools and districts that had been affected by the downturn in the oil and gas economy might have to be shuttered. "We had a plan to bridge that. Unfortunately, the Senate had other priorities." He attributed the failure to Patrick's fixation on vouchers. I asked Strauss about the clash between business and cultural conservatives, which was tearing the Republican Party apart, both in Texas and nationally. He quoted William H. Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, who described the forthcoming Civil War as an irrepressible conflict. The prejudices unleashed by the election of Donald Trump were mixing with the already volatile elements of Texas politics. Given that Dan Patrick had been Trump's campaign manager in the state, there was bound to be a confluence of interests. Referring to the bathroom bill, Strauss said, "We came very close this session to passing a sweeping discriminatory policy. It would have sent a very negative message around the country." That's still possible, right? I asked. Couldn't the governor just put forward his own bill and threaten to veto any amendments? Strauss agreed, but noted, the legislature is not obligated to act upon his agenda items within the 30-day period, and the governor would have the option to call as many 30-day sessions as he would like. So it could stay in committee and not get voted out, Strauss smiled. The session was the most fractious in memory, and the bad feelings stirred up in the Capitol will linger long after lawmakers return home. Immigrant communities are fearful, lawmakers are vengeful, and hate mongers feel entitled to spread their message. And the bitter battle among Texas Republicans wasn't yet over. Governor Abbott called a special session to convene on July 18th and set forth a list of 20 items that he said required action. Most of them could have been passed in the regular session. None of them were a priority for him before the session began. In addition to the bathroom bill, his list of demands included education vouchers, caps on state and local spending, and new abortion restrictions. He asked for a $1,000 pay raise for public school teachers, which the local school districts, not the state, would likely have to pay for. I expect legislators to return with a calm demeanor and with a firm commitment to make Texas even better, the governor declared. Strauss was not intimidated. He told me we're under no obligation to pass anything. Republican political consultant Karl Rove sometimes drops in on my regular Monday breakfast. He's a notorious figure in liberal Austin, a status he seems to relish. He's also a historian and writer, which is what draws him to our table. The week after the regular session closed, he sat down with us and we talked about how Texas turned red. Rove attributed the turnover in part to migration. People moved to Texas from somewhere else in the country, and that started to turn the urban areas Republican. The new Texans arrived with different political histories. My own family was part of that migration. My father was an Eisenhower Republican when we moved to Dallas in 1960. The Kennedy-Nixon campaign was underway, and Daddy was strongly for Nixon, although I think my mother secretly voted for Kennedy. She was always quiet about her politics. The Republicans didn't make Dallas a right-wing stronghold. It was already very conservative, but it became the first city in Texas to turn red in 1954 when it elected Bruce Alger, a real estate developer and political extremist, to Congress. Suburbs sprang up to accommodate the massive growth in Texas in the post-war decades, and they tended to be more like one another than like the cities they surrounded. Everything was new, the churches, the schools, the shopping centers, even the trees. Think about Williamson County, or better yet, Collin County. These were cow pastures in the 70s, Rove said. You used to be able to go to Frisco in Collin County, and there was one stoplight in it. Now it has 10 high schools. Unlike the cities, the suburbs were largely middle class and overwhelmingly white. There was a great sorting out, which left the cities poorer and more concentrated with minorities. The suburbs were organized around families who were seeking affordable homes and good schools. Suburbanites tended to have white-collar jobs, which meant that they were less likely than laboring Texans to belong to a union. They were more religious, often intensely so, belonging to massive evangelical congregations. All of these suburban characteristics, their relative affluence, their domination by white, non-union, church-going families, coincided with the core demographics of the emerging Republican majority. Rove also pointed to another factor, the sequential flow of parts of rural Texas into the Republican column. That process began in West Texas in 1978, then moved to the eastern and central parts of the state. By 1994, rural Texas had moved from being solidly Democratic to solidly Republican. That was where the progressives were in the old days, right? I asked. What changed in their condition that caused them to turn Republican? They were not so much progressives as they were populists, he replied. And populists think the system's rigged against them. They went from being economic populists who thought the system was rigged against the little guy, to social and conservative populists who thought that government was the problem. And also the effects of the Civil War finally wore off, Bill Brands observed. But when the National Democratic Party embraced civil rights, then the Southern Democrats decided this is no longer my party. The Democrats lasted longer in Texas than elsewhere in the South because the party remained relatively moderate, said Rove. Under Governor Ann Richards, however, the Democratic Party took a hard left turn. It was Rove who engineered her downfall. What accounted for her popularity? Steve asked. She was the aunt you loved to see at the family picnic every summer, Rove replied. Outrageous, say anything, do anything. At the beginning of the Bush campaign, Richards had a 67% approval rating and more than $4 million in her war chest. George W. had lost one congressional race and had no experience in politics, but thanks in part to Rove's political mastery, Bush beat the incumbent governor 53.5% to 45.9%, the widest margin of victory in 20 years. Karl Rove was born in an elevator in Denver on Christmas Day, 1950. He was one of five children. He would later learn that his father, a geologist, who left the family on the Christmas day that Karl turned 19, was actually not his real father. He had adopted the two children that Rove's mother had in a previous secret marriage. She was an unstable woman who eventually took her own life. According to reports, Louis Rove Jr., Karl's stepfather, lived the remainder of his life as a gay man. Karl was close to him until he passed away in 2004. Karl grew up in Colorado, Nevada, and Utah, and he imbibed the Republicanism of the Rocky Mountain West. At age 9, he stuck a Nixon bumper sticker on his bike, only to be attacked by a neighborhood girl who made her Democratic preferences known by giving him a bloody nose. It was his first political fight. He attended the University of Utah, although he never graduated. His focus was on getting elected president of the college Republicans. It would prove to be a legendary campaign. Managing the vote on southern campuses for Rove's presidential bid was Lee Atwater. The two of them would one day reshape American political campaigns, Atwater most notably as campaign manager for George H.W. Bush and his brutal victory over Michael Dukakis in the 1988 presidential campaign, and Rove with his involvement in George W. Bush's two gubernatorial victories in 1994 and 1998 and his presidential elections in 2000 and 2004. But their first victory was getting Rove elected. In 1973, in the rawest political contest the college Republicans had ever seen. Both Atwater and Rove came away with a reputation for using dirty tricks to win. Rove moved to Texas in 1977, at a time when the demographic changes in the state had not made themselves felt politically. But he was keen enough to recognize the trend. He was 26 years old, baby-faced, with wispy blonde hair and pinkish skin. He went to work for George H.W., who had lost two races for the U.S. Senate, but had formed a political action committee in preparation for an unlikely presidential run. John Tower was a Republican senator from Texas, but no other Republicans occupied statewide office. That changed the following year when Bill Clements, a gruff and extremely wealthy oil services provider who had been Nixon and Ford's deputy secretary of defense, got elected as the first Republican governor in Texas since Reconstruction. He ran against John Hill, the courtly former attorney general and chief justice of the Texas Supreme Court. Steve, who once profiled Clements, observed then, "Nobody really wanted a gentleman as governor of Texas when it was possible to have a roughneck. On election day, the world as Texas had known it for 100 years came to an end." Clements hired Rove to be his chief of staff. In 1981, Rove started a direct mail business in Austin and began running campaigns in Texas. Many of the earliest Republican victors in Texas owe their success to him. Rove also turned his attention to down-ballot races that the Republican Party had never taken seriously. In 1988, he consulted on the successful campaign of Kent Hance for the Railroad Commission, a powerful agency that, despite the name, actually regulates the oil and gas industry. That same year, he got Thomas R. Phillips elected to the Texas Supreme Court. Yes, we even elect judges in Texas. Although Republicans were still getting established in the state, we won in a landslide twice when Carl was helping me, Phillips told me. Moderate and conservative Democrats began following voters into the Republican Party, and Rove was there to get them elected. Rick Perry, for one, served 3 terms in the Texas House as a Democrat and even campaigned for Al Gore in his 1988 presidential bid before changing parties the following year. With Rove's guidance, he became Agriculture Commissioner in 1990. Eventually, Rove would elect 7 of the 9 justices